Hi, everybody. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
I tend to fiddle with this thing a little bit. I'm not on anything. I'm just nervous. I'm grateful to be here. Sam, thank you for asking me to come out tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. It's November 3rd, 2003. That's kind of when I landed. That's when the plane hit the ground really hard, and I scattered into pieces, and Alcoholics Anonymous chose to put me back together, and you guys have done a fine job of that. I'm grateful. You know, I'm grateful to be sober. I was 6 months sober, and I had the morning meeting that I attended, and I got sober in Long Beach, California, at a meeting called the Marina Pacifica Group. There's about 35 meetings in that hall of week. And I was a morning meeting attender. It started at 7 a.m. And I was having a hard time. I was having a real difficult time in my head with staying sober. I had the desire to drink wasn't there, but the desire to kill myself was. And I didn't know what to do with that. And I don't know that I had been honest up to that point. I don't think I had been outright lying to anybody about where I was or who I was or how I felt. But something happened that morning when they called the topic out to be gratitude. And that groan went over the crowd. And that meeting is about 150 people every morning. And that groan, and I felt inside that groan, and I was listening to people share. And it's not necessarily a meeting where you raise your hand. It is a discussion type of meeting. But I don't know what happened. I think God jumped in that morning and I raised my hand. And they called on me, and I stood up, and I think I told the truth in front of a group of alcoholics similar to you for the first time in my life. I said, I'm really scared. You talk about gratitude. You have gratitude. I don't know what it is, but I know that I don't have it. I have a feeling that if I don't get it, I'm not going to be able to stay here. And if I don't stay here, I'm going to die. That was my pitch that morning. And I sat down, and couple more people shared, and everybody, people who shared after me wished me well. And then a gentleman by the name of Grandpa Bob. And Grandpa Bob at that time was working. Bob doesn't work anymore. He's retired, and now we call him No Job Bob. But Bob stood up that morning. He was the last person to share, and he pointed over at me. And crosstalk's not a thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous much, but he pointed at me that morning and he said, Joe, he says, I don't know what it's going to take, but I sure hope you can find what we have. Because if you can't, you can't stay. Bob would not become my sponsor, or he was not my sponsor. And I felt that to be a little bit harsh that particular morning, but the fact of the matter was that was very true. It was a very true and honest thing. And more to the point was I had actually stood up and gotten honest with a group of people for the first time in my life, which identified. It allowed me to identify with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous because I knew this is where I belong. I had been there before. I had tried many times to be sober. I had had one period of time where I had had several years of sobriety. But I only stayed in AA for a couple of years at that time. But I knew something was different that time around. I don't know what it was. I came in desperate. I mean, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous desperate. I'm 6'3", 195 pounds as you see me today. I was same height, and I was 132 pounds. And I was dying of alcoholism, and I was dying of AIDS. And I didn't know what to do with my life. All I know is I'd been sitting, prior to getting to Long Beach, I had been sitting in I'd gone into a hospital again. See, in California, if you go into a community hospital in California, which is state-run, and you tell them that you are suicidal, they have to house you. And they put you on some fun little medications, and they bring you back down. And I was doing that off and on from time to time, and I had done it in Santa Barbara. And I don't know what happened that morning, but they had said there was going to be an AA meeting. And I hadn't talked to anybody in about 4 days, and I was sitting in my room. And then that night they came in, they stuck their head in and said, there's an AA meeting down the hall. And I don't know why, but I got up and I walked down the hall. Now, that morning, my mother had asked me not to die before her. And I told her, I don't think I can do that. I don't think that's going to work out. And I went down that hall and I went to that meeting. And there was a guy sitting there, half my age. He was 23 years old. And I sat down, and me and the two droolers, was in the psych ward. They were on something I wasn't on. Kind of wanted to be what they were on, but I wasn't. And that guy shared his story this morning. I don't know his name. I don't know whether he's still sober today, but he carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I heard was I heard a message of hope for some reason that rang true that day. So now I had been sober before, and now I knew what it took to get sober. I knew that there was work to be done. And I was very tired and very sick, and I didn't know what I could do. I was broken and bankrupt in all areas, and I didn't know what to do. So we'll get to that in a minute, but I will tell you this, that man, whoever he is, saved my life that day, because that was the day that I went to the nurse's station and said, I think I need to get sober. Can you help me? That was my prayer that day. Sometimes I'll get a little emotional. Sometimes I can't quite predict how it's going to roll up here. But that day, that young man saved my life. Now, I don't think he knows, but I pray for him now and then, and I thank him. I thank him for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me that day, because he carried it with clarity. And I don't know why I heard it, but I heard it. And it worked. So going back, you know, that was in Santa Barbara, California. I grew up there, and it's a beautiful place. I had no idea it was a beautiful place. I think the self-centeredness within me started very, very young in life. Didn't make me an alcoholic. I grew up in an alcoholic home. It wasn't an abusively alcoholic home. I just had a dad who seemed to be broke all the time, and didn't seem to be around much. It would be later in life that I would discover that as a sober man, I like to have events. I like to have parties at my house and people over and conviviality and joyousness and all of those things. I like that stuff. I really, really like that stuff. And I liked to party when I was drinking and all that kind of stuff. But in my house growing up, there was none of that. It wasn't a depressed place. There just wasn't any of that. And I would have to be an adult in my 30s before I would recognize that that kind of thing went on. I remember thinking in my teens, I would go over to, I had a friend, Mark Bodiani. Mark Bodiani was this Italian family, and they drank wine at the dinner table every night, and anyone under the age of 21 got about that much in a glass, a couple fingers worth of red wine and some spaghetti or whatever they were serving. And I thought it was so odd. And I didn't like the taste of it, so I didn't drink it. And I was kind of embarrassed. I was afraid something might happen to me if I drank it, so I didn't really partake. But I was interested in this life that they had. There were so many people. They had this massive dinner table and all these kids and neighbors. I mean, it was just this amazing little thing. And I remember my house was not like that, not at all. We didn't have people over to our house. And but at any rate, so I don't. My dad was an alcoholic. He was a binge drinker, and he was a hard worker. He was a hardworking man. He was a CPA. He did okay financially, but he would go on his vendors and he would spend everything. We'd be broke. We were constantly broke. Constantly, my mom was constantly pinching pennies to survive and to pay the bills. But in the meantime, I'm growing up in this beautiful town, and I'm a little surf rat kid, and I'm having a lot of fun, and it all seemed pretty normal to me. I had my little BMX bike and a surfboard, and life was grand, you know, and then skateboards, and I had those, and we did all sorts of crazy things on those, and my life as a child, it seemed relatively normal. I was rather restless, irritable, and discontent as a child. I didn't know what that was. I didn't have those words until you guys kindly gave them to me, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. I felt different and separate from others, but I had a feeling that other people felt the same way. So I was able to justify it somehow. And I didn't go, I feel different. And I didn't raise my hand because they didn't want to draw attention to me. I was a little bit shy. I didn't want to do those kinds of things. And so my childhood seemingly to me was rather normal. I mean, I did some normal things as a kid. When I got into high school and I was introduced to alcohol and some other substances, I mean, my first drunk was a blackout. I mean, it was full tilt boogie, man. We were up in the hills in Santa Barbara. I had been invited to go up with a group of people who were pretty popular, and I was not. And I went up on that hillside, and we looked over the beautiful city of Santa Barbara at night with the lights twinkling and the ocean, and there's a channel out there, and there's islands out there, and we're standing up there and we're drinking Boone's Farm wine. Woo! The good stuff. I thought it was the good stuff. I had no idea. I didn't know a Cabernet from Boone's. I didn't know what was what. But we're up there, and I got really, really drunk, and I proceeded to do what people who have never had that much booze in their system do, and I'm throwing up, and I'm blacking out, and I'm hanging out. They got me hanging. I was in a jump seat of a base station wagon sticking out. They had me hanging out the back end, and I'm just watching the white lines buzz by as they're trying to get me home and get me out of the vehicle. And because things are, I'm starting, things are not good. I'm not doing well. They get me home. They lean me up on the door. They knock on the door, and they leave. And something happened to me, not that night. I don't remember much of that night, but something happened to me the next morning. I got a phone call. This is back when phones had cords. But I had to go to the kitchen to take the call. I go in the kitchen, I take this call, and it's one of those guys who was so popular in my school. And he was laughing about all the stuff that we did last night. And I don't remember any of it, but I just laughed along with him, and that's when the lying started. I was a good kid. I wanted to be a priest. I was raised Catholic, and I wanted to be a priest. Happy Easter to anybody who is Catholic out there. But I was a good, honest, moral kid. I mean, I really was, right up to that point. I mean, I went to seminaries during the summer. I learned how to play guitar so I could sing Kumbaya. And I mean, there's all these, you know, I did all these things as a kid that was leading me down that path. And I knew that I had to have a calling with God, and I was waiting for this calling with God, and it never came in the form. I thought it was supposed to come in a white light form, and it never happened to me. And then I found the alcohol and the booze, and all of a sudden I started doing things that I was pretty certain no priest should do. And I just kind of pushed that aside. So my entire life up to that point, I had been developing as a person to be something. Introduction of alcohol. This stuff is over here. I'll take care of that later. And that's when I started throwing things in the back seat of the station wagon. They say one of the analogies of sobriety is life is like driving a station wagon your entire life. And every problem, every bill, every girlfriend, whatever you got just keeps, every time you just keep throwing, you get drunk and throw something else in the back seat, then you get sober, and it's like slamming on the brakes. And it all comes flying forward, and it all lands in your lap, and it's just a big old mess, and nobody knows how to sort it out. Maybe a sponsor can help you with that, but I mean, that's what sobriety felt like to me when I got sober this time. It was like all of it, all of the wreckage and damage that I had done, and it started as a teenager. I make it through my teenage years. By the time I'm 18, I'm in prison. I had been doing some different things. I had 62 felonies against me. I had all sorts of stuff. The state of Colorado was not happy with me. And to be quite honest with you, I'm not quite sure. I think I went there to be in the Air Force. Don't know, but they hired me at some point. I must have had a lucid day, I guess. I don't know. But I ended up in the Air Force, and I got washed out after 6 months because I couldn't seem to make it from the Airman's Club to my barracks. And I kept passing out on this bench in between, where the bus bench, and the third or fourth time that they found me there, they asked me to leave. So I left the Air Force with $1,100 and an airplane ticket back to California, and things just got progressively worse very fast for me. I was 6 days. I landed back in Colorado on this little junket for a crime spree thing, and I got busted, and I spent 3 years in prison. I was 18 years old, and I had so many problems, and I had no idea. If you had told me the day that the judge slammed the gavel down that the reason I was in the place I was in was because of alcohol and drugs, I would have laughed at you. I would have said, no way, that's not my problem, that's my solution. I don't know what the problem is. I went to an AA meeting in prison, and they lied. They said they had donuts. They did not. And AA just went in the back seat of the station wagon. It was just gone. they're not only drunks, they're liars. And I didn't know I was a liar at that point. I thought it was just a con. So I didn't know that they were one and the same. So I get out of prison, and within 6 days I got my first DUI. And a year later, on the same day, in the same intersection, by the same police officer, I got my second DUI. I would go on later to get three and four within that 10-year span. And my license was questionable. I never really stopped to look and see if I had one or not. I just kept driving. And and my drinking in my 20s progressed to an extreme. It just lit on fire. I was running bars, I was working in bars and managing bars and restaurants, and they had all the booze in the world. And I'd gotten that Ford DUI, and I was 27 years old, and it was the first time in my life that I had decided I was going to stop drinking, and it was for somebody else, for her. She had come along, she was beautiful, she was successful, she had her own home, I had nothing, it looked really good, and I was going to move up to the L.A. area out of San Diego. I was living in San Diego at the time, and I was going to move up to the L.A. area and start my life over. See, little did I know that I suffered from the disease of alcoholism, that I was deep inside the folds of alcoholism at that time. I didn't know that a day would come when I would want to stop and I would not be able to. I didn't know that when I took the first drink, I wouldn't be able to, with any certainty, tell you when the last one would be. I didn't know where I would end up. I had no idea. I didn't know that alcohol did that to me. I thought that was just me. I thought that I was the problem, and I thought that that was just who I was. That's what I did. I'm a little crazy. I'm a little fun. Woohoo! And that's the kind of person I thought I was. So that's just what I did. And I never stopped. I never stopped to look and see. I never stopped to even think about what I was doing to other people, or how I was mistreating my family, or any of those kinds of things. I just thought they were all a little upset with with me, and they just needed to get over it. If they did that to me, I would get over it. And I justified so many things in my life. This woman, we had a bit of a romance going on, but I drank a lot, and she enjoyed the party for a minute, and then it got to be about 6 months into that relationship, and she said, "You know what? This drinking thing isn't working out for me anymore." You know, and it had never dawned on me that I couldn't drink, that I would not be able to stop drinking of my own will. I had willed myself into many things. I had a pretty reasonable job. I mean, I had a felony record. I didn't tell anyone I had one. I lied. But you know, I had a reasonable life going on, and I couldn't manage to pay my bills, my rent, and I didn't have a car. But in my head, all I had to do was just get those things, and I'd be okay. And I could get those things if I wanted to. I just don't want them. Every time I would lose something, I would simply say, "Oh, I didn't want that anyways." I would just justify it away, just push it away, and move on to the next thing. This woman asked me to slow down on my drinking, and I found myself unable to. And it was the first time that I had probably done this many times, but it was the first time that I had tried to control and enjoy my drinking. I didn't have those words until I got here, but that's what it was. I was trying to control and enjoy my drinking. So what I would do is, I was living in San Diego, she was up in L.A. I would see her two or three days out of the week up in L.A., and on the three or four, I would drink like I drank. I would drink to oblivion 3 or 4 days out of the week, and then I would go up to L.A., and I would try to behave. And then I found myself sneaking booze. You know, I found myself with little bottles in my pocket. That little agave thing back there, whatever you got going on back there, that little bottle looks like that's a nice looking little pint back there. Pretty orange liquid. I love bourbon. Woo, making me thirsty. But I started doing things that I wasn't, that I had not done before. Now, I didn't know that I had alcoholism. I don't know what's going on with me, but I'm starting to exhibit some behaviors that are even different for me. And I'm starting to see them. I'm starting to recognize them. And in the news, a lot of HIV and AIDS was in the news a lot. And I've had a lot of medical problems in my life, and the number one problem being that, being HIV and AIDS and the consequences of that and the sicknesses that come along with that. I've survived all of that. I've had it for 30 years, and I went through some pretty rough times with it. But I don't say it for sympathy. I just simply say that it is what drove me to my bottom. I was given a diagnosis, a medical diagnosis, like anyone would. Like any alcoholic might get a cancer diagnosis. When I was given a medical diagnosis, the prognosis was that I would die within 3 years. And I'm an alcoholic who is in his cups. I am deep in my disease. I'm drinking heavily every day at this point in my life. And I'm given a death sentence. Basically, what I'm given is a pass to die. And a pass to drink as I will. And it is all your fault. It is everyone's fault. It was an accident that I got that disease. and I'll be damned if I'm not going to make you pay for it. And that's when I turned the tables and I just didn't care anymore. I rode everyone I loved into the ground. I drove them all into the ground in a very short period of time. I drove those jobs into the ground. Those women who wanted to care for me and love for me and protect me, I drove them away. Everything good in my life. Now, I thought this was this other disease doing this. The truth is, what it is it's acute alcoholism. And, if alcoholism was an entity, this is what was explained to me early in my sobriety, was that if alcoholism was an entity, what it would be is a business that is designed to separate me from everything good in my life and then kill me. That's it. I'm going to die alone on the hill. That's it. There's not going to be anyone around. There won't be anyone at my funeral. There won't be anybody coming around to shake hands. There won't be anybody to say, poor Joe. Because first of all, they're not even going to know where I'm at. Because I'm not telling anybody anything. I'm not telling anybody the truth. So I tried really hard to drink myself to death, and I didn't. I just survived. I don't know how. But I survived this thing, and I roll up on 1993, and I don't know what's going on in my life, but I landed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in Santa Barbara, and I met a man by the name of Ken Chappell, and Ken Chappell became my first sponsor in sobriety. It was the first time I had ever made any sort of effort of being sober. It's 1993, and I'm doing everything. Ken is a busy guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's doing everything. He's got me out there. I'm out at these picnics setting forks on tables. The wind's blowing. The forks are blowing away, and I'm like, why are we doing this? He said, just set the forks. And I'm setting forks, and I'm cleaning coffee cups at meetings, and I'm emptying ashtrays, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I'm walking into rooms, and there's a smoking section over here and a non-smoker section over here. And over here, they got cigarettes, and over here, there's just this giant cloud covering the non-smoking people. I don't understand anything that's going on, but I'm just doing it. He takes me through that book, and he takes me through those steps, and I am thorough. I am thorough with everything. I know that the jig is up. I know how to do... that kind of stuff. I had been raised to be a moral individual, and I knew how to drop that stuff, and I knew how to talk to another man or another human being about that stuff, and I took those steps with the utmost thoroughness that I could at that time in my life. And I was given this really good life. Within a very short period of time, I had the job, I had the house, I had the wife, I had the car, I had the truck. I had the beautiful life that Alcoholics Anonymous can produce if you work hard. I worked real hard, and in 2 years I stood up in that home group meeting that I had been attending almost every day for 2 years, and I told those people, I said, thank you very much for the information. I got it from here. I didn't want them to worry about me. That's why I raised my hand and told them. No ego. It wasn't that. The ego had, no. Jeez. So I thought, oh, poor people, they'll miss me horribly. And I moved on with my life, and I wouldn't take a drink again for another 4.5 years. So I had been sober for a couple of years and dry for about 6.5. And I had been asked to go to a party in Santa Barbara. There in Santa Barbara, they had this thing called it's kind of the first weekend in August. It's called the Fiesta, Santa Barbara Fiesta. And there's the dignitarios, all the dignitaries who run this event, and literally the city shuts down for about 4 days, and it's a party. And I had been invited to this. I was sitting at one of the head tables. I had arrived. I mean, I am. Let me close my button on that. And I'm sitting at the head table, and I am regaling everyone at my table. It's an open bar, and there's bands playing. Popular, famous bands are playing, and it is one of those types of events. And I'm regaling everyone with my story of how I haven't had a drink in 6.5 years. So you know, I did not credit AA for any of that. I simply said I had not had a drink in 6.5 years, and my wife hasn't had a drink. And they were fascinated as they had a couple of drinks in 2.5 hours. My wife came over to me with a bottle of Patron tequila, and she said, I'm going to take a shot. I said, I'll have one. Now, the look on their face changed because they had heard some of my drunken stories, and they were, it was almost like fear. There was just a dense like fog of fear that landed on the table. The minute I said that, she put that shot down in front of me. And I believe to this day that what separates me from the normal person, the average temperate drinker, and me as the alcoholic, is the thought that went through my head the moment I touched that shot glass. I picked up that shot glass and I thought to myself, if it gets bad, I'll just go back to AA. Like that's a choice. Like you just get to do that. Took that shot. Got a little buzz that night. Nothing bad happened. And that immediate sense of ego and self-centeredness came in. And I went, oh, see? It's not like they said. It's not at all like they said. 6 months go by, nothing bad's happened. I've gone to a bar, shot some pool a couple times, nothing bad happens. I moved down to San Diego with my wife, and we buy this little piece of property. We've got a couple of horses out there, and kind of isolated. Now I'm isolated a little bit. I'm away from, see, in Santa Barbara, all those AA people were all over, and I couldn't, like, drink out in public because, you know, I didn't, wouldn't want any of them to think badly of me because that's all I care about is me, and I get a little more freedom down in San Diego, and I start drinking a little more, and I start adding some other things into the picture, and seemingly in a very short period of time, the wife is leaving, the horses are gone, I'm not living in that house anymore, I have a vehicle that's not registered, I have a license that's expired, and I have no insurance. I'm now living down in this little hovel in San Diego and Oceanside. It's a little pit of an apartment. It's a low-income housing apartment that I could get because I had AIDS. And all of a sudden, I'm alone. And it seemed like in a very short period of time, my life just fell apart. It all went away, and I could not. Everything I had learned in Alcoholics Anonymous and the time that I had spent in Alcoholics Anonymous, that 2 years that I was so active in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not bring back with any recollection, with any sense of memory. Could not bring back the pain and suffering of a week, a month, or a day ago. I couldn't bring any of it back. I couldn't bring it back. I didn't know what was happening to me. I didn't understand. And it was taking on a new level. There's a lot of nakedness involved. And I never understood what was going on with me, but I was a very troubled individual. And I would drink and I'd get really hot and I didn't know what was going on with me. I'm falling apart. I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm getting really, really sick medically, and I'm spiritually, and emotionally, physically bankrupt in all areas of my life. And I don't understand what's going on. I could not remember the progressively worse part of this thing. Always worse. Never better. Always worse. Never better. It says that, and I couldn't bring to mind any of that. Anything you guys have taught me in that period of time, enough time had elapsed. A 7, 8, 10 year period had elapsed, and I was not able to bring to memory with any consciousness what you guys had taught me in that 2.5 years that I was so active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tried going to a couple meetings here and there, but every time I sat down in a meeting, I knew that I wasn't going to stay, so I didn't come back. You would invite me and you would be kind and you would ask me to come back. You would ask me to dinner. You would ask me out to coffee. You had did a lot of things in that 4 year period that I was back out there. And I couldn't partake of any of it because I was absolutely certain that I was not going to do what you were asking to do. I felt no point in it. What's the point? And that disease had gotten really bad. I was very, very sick physically. And I was praying every day to die. Just take me. Just God, if you will, please just take me. I can't do this anymore. And somebody mentioned a little story. So this is sad that when I've had the opportunity to stand at a podium quite a bit, and it's kind of sad that anybody from someplace as far removed as this from Long Beach, California would even know this story. But I'm in Santa Barbara, and I'm not doing too well. And somewhere in that period of time that I was out, I took a hit of crack cocaine for about 4 years. And when I would do that, I would get really, really hot, and I could not. So I'm driving down, the 405 freeway. Out of Santa Barbara on my way down to meet the guy who has that stuff that I like to do. I took the 73 freeway down there, which is the only toll booth freeway in all of Southern California. And I'm on it. And now I have broken every law in the book. I'm driving naked. This is like the first thing. This is like, and here's my thinking. Here's the rationale that's going on in my head. I have not had a drink that day. Here's why I haven't had a drink. Because if I get pulled over, they're going to know I'm drinking. They're going to smell the booze. They're not going to see the googly eyes and the crack cocaine in the pipe and the naked body in the seat. They're going to, it's just going to be, sir, you smell like you've been drinking. So I'm not drinking. I'm not drinking, but I'm doing all that other stuff. Now the toll booth goes over there and the freeway, the fast pass goes over there. Now I don't even have a license, but I'm worried about going through the fast pass. Because I'll get a ticket. So I go through the toll. So I pull up to the toll, and I'm driving a truck, and the toll booth's about there, and the truck's about here. Now I know she can't see any of my privates. And I do the old roll down the window, "Whoa, good evening, ma'am." She says, "That'll be $4, sir." And I got my seatbelt on. I'm like, oh. And I look around, and my pants are on the floorboard of the passenger seat. Just a second. This. And all of this goes up into the window and well, there's not much there, but enough of it goes up in the window. And I turn around and she is like this. She's standing behind, and I hand her a $5 bill and it's $4, and she does this and she takes the five and I said, "Keep the change." Hits the gas. So, and I think this is normal behavior. I mean, I'm thinking, well, you know, that might have been a little disturbing for her, but whatever, she'll get over it. She's probably seen worse. So I'm. Long story short, where am I here? Okay, so I need to get sober. So this goes on for a little while, and I end up, like I told you in the beginning of my story, I end up in this hospital in Santa Barbara, and this guy shares his story, and I decide I'm going to get help, and I get. My mom, who is still the only person, although I'm not allowed in her home, she will allow me in her vehicle if I'm being taken somewhere other than her home. And she took me down to L.A. Her and my stepfather took me down to L.A. And they dropped me off at this low-bottom indigent recovery center called SAF in Long Beach, California. And I did not belong in such a place, but so I thought. Turns out I did. It was perfect for me. And they introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had counselors and treatment people, and they took me in their van. They took me to see doctors for the HIV, and I started getting on medications, and I started getting a little better. And then from 132, I jumped up to about 180 pounds pretty quick. And so I'm recovering physically, I'm recovering mentally. And then about 75 days in, I start getting pretty arrogant that they're not treating me very kind. That they should have advanced me through that program faster. Don't they know who I am? And the arrogance, and I'm not sober at all. What I am is I'm dry and very angry. And I didn't treat those people very kindly. They have about 210 people in that program down there, and I was probably one of the worst people they had in there when it came to attitude and how I treated them. I treated them very poorly. I treated them very angrily. I can be very vicious with my words. And I was with them. And I stayed there 75 days, and I walked out of that treatment center, and I landed in a sober living home because I knew I could get in there with minimal amount of money, and I think it was $100 to get into the sober living house, and I drank. Shortly after that, about 10 months sober, I had moved in with a girl because she had a house. She had everything that I thought I needed in order to stay sober, and I drank again. The day after I drank, I went back to that morning meeting that became my home group, and there was my first day of sobriety. There was a gentleman by the name of Miles Evans. I say last names. I only say them in here because these gentlemen say their last name from the podium. I say it from the podium in this format. I do not say anything. I do not associate myself with AA outside of the rooms of AA. If people need help, I will gladly tell them where a meeting is, and that maybe I'll talk to them if they go there. But I'm pretty rigorous about not being anonymous or breaking any anonymity outside of these rooms. But a guy by the name of Miles Evans, who is sponsored by a gentleman by the name of Frank Honeycutt. And Frank Honeycutt is a woman by the name of Polly Pistol, who's pretty well known around the country as a speaker. And Polly was sponsored by Frank for a long time, and then she was sponsored by Dottie Harris, and then sponsored by Johnny Harris, and Johnny and Dottie started the Bellflower Big Boat group. Anyways, my lineage, I got very, very lucky to have landed in such a hall, because my first day of sobriety, and I was shaking and trembling and so afraid of what was happening. I was homeless and helpless, and I didn't know what to do. And I sat across the table with that cup of coffee, and I just happened to sit across from this guy. And at the end of chapter 5, when it says, God could and would if he were sought, this gentleman reached over, he touched my hand, and he said, Joe, it's going to be okay. If you can seek God, you can have all of this. And I can still feel it. To this day, on occasion, when I have a bad moment, I'll tighten that hand up and I'll remember what it was like to have somebody. I don't know why I trusted that man that day, but I asked him to be my sponsor a couple of days later. And he would sponsor me for about 9 years. My first 9 years of sobriety, I was sponsored by Miles. I did everything you can do wrong. I was got into a relationship early in sobriety. I was like 8 days sober, and she walked by and she's tall and little heels click 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 click, and I thought lunch couldn't hurt. After the meeting, I asked her out to lunch, and we both agreed that sobriety was going to be a priority. Now, at this point, now trust me, I was not I was not a vision for you at the time, and I'm sleeping on the floor of that sober living that I had been asked to leave. I'm sleeping on the dining room floor, and everyone in the house had to agree that it was okay for me to sleep there. And I've got a little blow up twin bed mattress, and I'm working. I'm doing a little handyman business, and I got a little bit of money in my pocket. But there was one of the beds was going to be opening up at the end of the month. It was the beginning of the month, and so I'm sleeping on this floor every morning. And these guys are coming out, and they're getting me cups of coffee, and they're helping me get dressed and go. And I start seeing her, and I stay on the floor. And I remember I told her very specifically. I said I had a sponsor one time, long ago, tell me that I couldn't do anything for a year. Nothing. He goes, Joe, I've known you for 10 years and you've never done anything, not one thing consistently for 1 year. Why don't you try doing that? Anything. Pick something and just do that for a year. So I made a commitment to that sober living that I would stay there. And I stayed there that first year. I stayed in that relationship. I was in that relationship for 8 years. One of the greatest gifts, and this usually brings me to tears, she had two daughters. And when I met them, they were 7 and 10. And I just helped the youngest one graduate from UCLA. And the other one is a basket case. But she doesn't have the drinking and drugging problem. She's 25 and just uncentered. She just doesn't quite know what she wants to do. But she's trying real hard. She's doing lots of stuff. They're wonderful young women. That relationship ended after 8 years with their mother. But my relationship with them did not. And they've been an amazing blessing in my life for somebody who couldn't take the risk of having children. So, anyways, I'm in this relationship. So I've been through relationships. I've been through the good, the bad, the ugly. At 9 years sober, I had developed cancer. I had cancer of the bladder. And I hadn't gotten real sick. And they didn't want to do chemo. They just wanted to do a surgery, and the surgery went good, and the tumor was removed, but I got very, very ill from it. I don't have a strong immune system, even to this day. I don't have a very real strong immune system, and so when I go through some traumas, I tend to get affected by them. But what I had learned and what was different this time is that I had buried myself in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to two meetings a day for a number of years, and I would not. The only time I didn't go was either if I was sick or if I was out of town. Many times when I was out of town, I would find a meeting out of town. I did not go anywhere unless I knew where there was a meeting. Most of my trips were to Santa Barbara. So I'm going to run through the steps real quick. Miles took me through those steps. He wasn't as thorough as Ken, that first sponsor I had, but he did a fine job, and I credit a lot of my sobriety and the kindness, the human being that I am, the kind man that I can be today, is a result of being next to that man for 9 years. and the result of him being that way was standing next to a gentleman by the name of Frank Honeycutt. And Miles, it was an interesting ride. I used to have to chase him down. Hey, when are we going to do step work? And he goes, we're going to a meeting. We just went to a lot of meetings. And then we started doing those steps slowly but surely. And on step one, the powerlessness, that's obvious. I mean, when I take a drink, I can't control it now, nor can I guarantee you with any certainty what the outcome will be. I cannot control and enjoy, as I mentioned earlier. I just simply can't. I can do one or the other. If I'm controlling it, I am not enjoying it. And if I'm enjoying it, I am out of control. So I know about the powerlessness, this unmanageability that we talk about. You know, booze, no booze. If I have a job, I'm pretty good for about 90 days. I'll get that job and be the best employee you ever had for about 90 days. After about 6 months, some of that behavior that you haven't caught me on yet, starting to catch up with me around 6 months, 3 months to 6 months, right around 6 to 9 months, I know you're probably getting ready to fire me. And between 9 months and 12 months, I'm looking for another job before you fire me. And that's that consistency that sponsor had talked to me about not doing anything for 1 year because I had done a fifth step with him and he had heard all that. So he knew a lot about me. He recognized things about me when I can't see them myself. Other people in Alcoholics Anonymous can tell me about those people that I trust can tell me. And Miles and I did something similar in regards to that unmanageability. We just simply went through my life a little bit. We just took a little stroll through my life and we discovered that my life, even sober, was unmanageable. You know, 8 days sober and I'm basically taking a hostage. Now, I treated her well and I treated her kind and I loved her kids as best I could. And I was a very good stepfather to their kids and to this day I am. But the truth is that probably, I don't know if that should have happened or not. I don't know if that was God's will or my will. I still hear the click, click, click of her heels, and I'm pretty sure it's my will. The unmanageability all of a sudden kind of became when I started doing some step work and putting some pen to paper. I could see that my life was unmanageable. It wasn't about just not paying bills. It was about the confusion that goes on in my head on a daily basis. Even to this day, I can find myself in great confusion about my life. In general, where am I going? What am I doing? Why am I doing that? I'm in the middle of buying a house. I'm like, why am I buying a house? You know, and I mean, all these kinds of things that I constantly second guess my questions because I made so many poor decisions when I was young. So I haven't grown up some. Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out that unmanageability and that it's a two-part step. Step two came to believe I wanted to be a priest. I always knew that God was going to be the answer to my problems. I had just done so many bad things in my life that I was absolutely certain that there wasn't a God on the planet that would have anything to do with a man like me, let alone forgive me. But through that step, I was able to ask for some forgiveness and a little bit of grace. Give me the grace to do the rest of this. Step three, again, Not complicated for me. I'd always believed in a God, a power greater than myself. I had some trouble with the religious aspects of that God, and somebody taught me at that point in my life taught me to set aside prayer, and it said every day I want you to wake up and say this prayer. I had been saying other prayers, but they wanted me to say that one in particular because I was having such a difficult time with the concept of God and God being in my life and in my heart. And how do I get it from my heart to my head? Because my head is trying to convince me that this is not a good thing for me. That I'm never going to be able to toe the line. I will break this rule again and again and again. Because I always have. How do I change that? So I developed this pattern of prayer. And all of a sudden I start developing some spirituality in my life. And spirituality is simply the word spirit and the spirit and ritual. Overlapped. The last three words of spirit are R-I-T. The last three letters are R-I-T and the first three letters are ritual or spiritual. If you put a ritual together with some spiritual acts, you will get spirituality. That's how it was explained to me and it needed to be that simple for me to make that connection. So I started saying that set-aside prayer and I started acting and behaving better and all of a sudden those behaviors, I started feeling a little spiritual. I was able to say a prayer and feel like I was actually talking to God. But was I listening? I wasn't at that 11th step year. I wasn't there yet. So I was starting to question some things, and I was just asked to put that on hold and say that set-aside prayer again and put those things aside. That fourth step was relatively simple for me. The damage had not been brutal. In that 4 years, I had wrecked all the people that loved me, but I had not done a lot of financial because I just didn't have any. So there's all sorts of weird things that went down on my fourth step. A whole bunch of different thoughts that probably should belong in 6 and 7. Who knows? But either way, I went through that list. I made that list. I put pen to paper. I did it to the best of my ability that day. Now, more has been revealed, and I have done many other things since that day. But on that day, on that particular day, I did that fourth step with the thoroughness that I knew best, and I was as honest as I could be with that fourth step. I put down all those people that offended me. I put down why they offended me. All those people I had resentments against, why I had resentments against them. What was that? And then I would get later on, I would be able to go back on those three and look back and see what my part in all that was. And what it did is it developed me, it turned me into a man that was capable of seeing a situation for what it was. For not necessarily looking at you and me right now, but maybe levitating a little bit and seeing how you see me. How is this being presented? How am I? Do I present myself well to the next man? I need to be armed with the facts about myself in order to go up to another man and tell him the truth about me. If I'm not armed with those facts, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know where I'm going. So coming out of that fifth step and being honest with my sponsor and saying all of those things out loud, those things that I'm so terrified of. I'm just so terrified. I'm so terrified what you think of me. Paul Epistle says this a lot when she shares. She talks about this unique dynamic that and Frank Honeycutt, that sponsor of hers, I got to listen to him for a couple of years, my first years in sobriety, while he was still alive, and he used to say that what you think of me absolutely does not matter, but what I think of you has the power to kill me. So I've got to change that person. I've got to change the person who's constantly judgmental of other people. I'm more than willing to point a finger at you and not recognize the three you're pointing back at me. I'm always willing to point out someone else's faults. I'm rarely willing to look at my own. I get into 6 and 7 in the book. It's a short little romp. It's a couple of paragraphs on a page. But the truth of the matter is, it is much deeper than that. There is a prayer surrounding that. And so I get into 6 and 7, and I go home and I sit down for about an hour, and I make sure that I have built a foundation through which I can walk through the rest of my life. Now, I know that things will come up in my life, and I know that I will need to make changes, that I will need to adapt, that people will offend me, and I will need to deal with that offense somehow. And I know that in 6 and 7, I identify my defects of characters and my shortcomings. And I know that 6 and 7 now, I know that when they wrote those steps, they were basically the same thing. They just didn't want to use the same set of words twice. So they went from shortcomings to defects of character. So basically they're kind of the same thing, but I think they're one of the most important steps because it again, without being armed with the facts about myself, who and what I am, the kind of man I am, how I view the world around me and how I treat people in general. I want to be treated well, but how am I treating you? How am I treating you? If I'm treating you poorly, then everything that comes back to me, I probably deserve it. 8, I make that list. So I make that list of amends. Again, I told you I had made a lot of, in my first round of sobriety, I made all those financial amends. There wasn't a lot of financial wreckage. There was some, not much. That place that I was housed in that they allowed me to live there. There was some rent that was unpaid there, and I made. That was easy for me to make. I'm a hard worker. I usually do pretty well when I put the effort in at work, and I was able to make those pretty easily. But the living amends, most of my 8-step amends were to my family and to the people who loved me the most. I used to say that I had earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I had survived so much and I earned that seat. And the truth is, I didn't earn it. The people who loved me the most paid for it. They paid through every poor action that I ever took. They paid with the lies. My mother begged me not to die before her. Who's paying the price, really? Because I'm in oblivion, and she's at home not sleeping. I make those amends. 10, I start to take things on my own. I start to recognize some of my faults. I start to recognize them quickly, and I start saying prayers at night that remind me that if I've offended somebody or hurt somebody, that I need to make that right. 11 and 12, prayer and meditation. I'm not good at meditation. I'm really good at talking. I'm not good at listening. Prayer is talking. Meditation is listening. And I don't do that as well as I can, but I practice it to the best of my ability. Sometimes I have some pretty good days. Sometimes I don't. 12 step. I take hostages. I dragged Matt up here tonight because it was a long ride. So I'm more than willing to do for Alcoholics Anonymous what it is so gracefully done for me. I've had a lot of difficulties in my life as far as like some real kind of things I've had. That was not my last round of cancer. I would have that again, and that would be a year-long ride that I don't ever want to have to take again. I do some medical things now that help me maybe prevent that or at least recognize it if it comes on me again. That was a hard ride that landed me in the hospital at 12 years of sobriety. I was in a psychiatric hospital wanting to die. I had hit a brick wall in sobriety. At 9 years sober, I was at a conference, and a friend of mine named Steve Lee, who speaks at quite a few conferences, and I pulled him aside and I said, "I'm struggling," and I told him what was going on because I had learned how to be honest with another man. And what he told me that day is one of the most profound things I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me that my physical sobriety had surpassed my spiritual growth, and that if I didn't get God, I would drink again. The suggested action from my sponsor at that time was to get another sponsor who's more focused on the spiritual aspect of the program. So I did. That sponsor taught me how to surrender to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 9 years sober before I think I truly surrendered. And surrender is simply, you're right and I'm wrong. I've been wrong about most things. All the things going on in my life that I think I'm right about. I have a good job, a lot of responsibility, and I am right a lot. That is my job. My job is to point out the defects and correct them, come up with a plan of action and correct them. But when it comes to my personal life, I don't get to apply that principle. I need to be kind rather than right. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to do that. So in closing, I want to thank you again for having me up here tonight. I believe that I have survived, and my purpose here in Alcoholics Anonymous is not necessarily to stand at a podium and pass a word. It's to sit across the table from that gentleman right there and go through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and get him to where he's having an experience that he might be able to do the same thing with another man. That's what I believe is my purpose. I believe I lived as long as I have, simply because God's grace is raining down around us constantly. It's pouring on us, and I believe my only job is to close my umbrella and feel it. Thank you for letting me share.